You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā kātou katoa, ko Adam toku ingoa, nā mai haere mai ki te wire. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 12th of July. My name is Adam Jacobson, and I'm joined in studio by my producers, Will and India. How are you guys going?
Doing good.
You're doing good? That's good to hear. Well, we've got an exciting show coming up for you today. So first off, we speak to Frank Hogan from Child Poverty Action Group about housing concerns and new policies from Labor. Tracy Martin from New Zealand First joins us again this week. We will be talking about recent allegations made by the Green Party of racist immigration stances and an introduction of woolen flooring policies. We chat to AUT's Alan Blackman for Dear Science about needle-like nanoparticles found in baby formula and creationists who have sued the Grand Canyon. And we'll have more as well. The former editor of Mana magazine, Leonie Hayden, joins us to talk about its owner's decision to halt production. And as usual, if you want to let us know your opinion, please give us a text message on 5395 or give us a phone call on 309 3879.
The Wire.
Yes, so first up on The Wire is a story by Will. Take it away.
Andrew Little has announced a new policy that would increase funding to social housing through winter. This increase is intended to target those households with children which have previously been growing up in cold and unforgiving home environments, leading to sickness and further issues. I spoke to Frank Hogan, the housing issues spokesperson for Child Poverty Action Group, asking him what effect poor housing standards have on children.
Well, there are multiple effects. Firstly, there are just the plain physical and mental stresses of insecure and poor housing. Poor quality housing in terms of either warmth or weather tightness. Children get ill if they are exposed to damp conditions. That has impacts on their, obviously upon their physical health, the stress levels, and it flows on to education, their poor school attendance and the like. But the greater issue is that children thrive in stability and security. That's most probably beyond argument, that proposition. So therefore, the aim of any compassionate government is to ensure that more and more children live in conditions of stability, security and warmth.
And going off that, I know Andrew Little has proposed actions to solve or attempt to solve these issues, but do you know of any actions that have been taken already?
Well, there have been piecemeal responses, but basically, again, it's beyond argument. What's happened in the last generation, the last 20 to 30 years, is that there's been greater and greater stress placed on families at the lower end of the spectrum in terms of economic power. They have been forced to either club together, live in multiple family units in the one house, giving rise to stresses and strains and the like, or they get tipped out at the lower end into cars, garages, and we've read numerous, endless almost, sad tales of people struggling at that level. So that's something that's been emerging at a structural or society level. In recent times, is the negative outcomes from families living under stress, and what Child Poverty Action Group is there to advocate on behalf of the children, because the children of those families are the least powerful of all.
What is Andrew Little's proposal, and how does it benefit children living in low-income households?
Well, at one level, the injection of money at a critical time of the year, when power bills and the like loom as very significant outcomes over that winter 4 or 5 month period, sure, that's a band-aid that's very welcome, and it's targeted, and will no doubt give relief to many people who scrimp and save, and that the HRV report that's just come out is confirmation that families go without over these critical winter months, when the power costs become ever more demanding on an already stretched budget. So, yep, it's a timely, targeted response, and one would have to applaud it. It's not the complete answer, though. It's not the magic lozenge that's going to solve the problem, or solve the wider problem.
What would you say could be implemented to address this issue in broader context?
Well, there has to be a stock. There has to be a return to a good stock of affordable, safe, warm housing. Essentially, the numbers have become run down in recent times, and there has to be a return. We've done it in the past. We've housed our families, our most vulnerable, and we have to go back to the basic principles of acknowledging that the state has a role in setting the absolute bottom line for children and their families to both not only survive but to thrive. That plainly is our responsibility as a compassionate society, and I don't believe that there would be many that would argue against that proposition in New Zealand.
What are you looking to have changed in the upcoming election? Because it is an important election, and what sort of policies would you and Child Poverty Action Group be looking to see?
Well, essentially across the board, housing is looming, particularly in the pressure point areas of Auckland and the Upper North Island. There is enormous social strain caused by an insufficient housing stock. So it needs to be a multi-pronged major undertaking, not piecemeal and a bit of drip feeding around the edges. There has to be a vision and a plan that addresses what is becoming an ever more apparent cancer upon our society, namely the housing stock is run down. It's inadequate, both in terms of quality and in terms of numbers. That's it in a nutshell, I believe.
Around, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was producer Will talking to Frank Hogan about the impacts of Labour's policy on housing and child poverty in the upcoming election. Just after the break, we will be back with Tracy Martin.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Kia ora, Tracy. Are you there?
I am.
Hello,
sorry,
hello.
Excuse my voice. I've got the flu.
Oh, no. That's sad to hear. So today I thought I'd start out with one of the main controversies which has come out over the past week has been this back and forth between New Zealand First and the Green Party. This all started last Sunday when Green Party co-leader Matiria Ture said on Q&A that New Zealand First and Winston Peters have a very racist approach to immigration policy. What are your takes on these allegations, Tracy?
First of all, I think it's just really, really disappointing. And it's disappointing on lots of levels. For me personally, I've worked really closely with Catherine Delahunty, with Kennedy Graham. Kennedy Graham and I are on the executive of Globe New Zealand, working around climate change for the country. Catherine and I work on education really closely. Jan Logie and I have worked together to support women's legislation through the House. So it's really, really disappointing to then actually hear, from the co-leader of the Greens that as far as they're concerned, I practice divisive politics. So that was a shame. I thought that was a real shame. Secondly, their values, number six of their values is that they will engage respectfully without personal attacks. So that's kind of a shame that they went there. And if you have a look at our immigration policy, even Matiria yesterday on the radio said that there are parts of it that they absolutely agree with. And none of our immigration policy is based on race. So I just think overall it was really, really disappointing.
Why do you think she would have come out stating these allegations then? Do you feel like she has no basis to be accusing NZ First about this?
Well, I think I didn't really understand it on the day, but then a poll came out that showed that New Zealand First and the Greens are sitting around about level, according to that poll, which is around about 11%. So I guess then it made a little bit more sense to me.
Yeah. You have to admit, though, that Winston Peters does have a long history of negative rhetoric towards the race of immigrants coming into New Zealand. For example, he described New Zealand as the last Asian colony in, I think it was back in the 90s, and then just recently he came out berating two Asian New Zealand Herald journalists for writing a pro-immigration article. I mean, you must see where she might be coming from this, right?
Well, I'd have to ask this question. Are those two journalists Asian?
Yes, they were.
Right. So, because I think it's Jack McDonald, who is the young Green Party candidate that was on The Nation, I think, or something on the weekend. He put out a tweet after he'd been on there saying that sitting on a plane, listening to the air hostess, heavy Asian accent, but beautiful te reo Māori.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that racist to mention that she had an Asian accent?
No, not of course.
Right, so I guess it depends who's saying it, does it? Who's pointing out that in one context it's okay to say that this person, who's obviously Asian, because Jack could have just said, listening to some beautiful te reo Māori. But in the other context, apparently it's not okay for the Right Honourable Winston Peters to mention the person's ethnic background.
But Winston was insinuating that the Asian New Zealand Herald journalists were trying to further their own basically racial bias rather than just complimenting them on the where they are from.
Was he?
Yeah.
That's your interpretation of that sentence, was it?
Mm.
But that's your interpretation of that sentence. That's your interpretation of that sentence. That's not what that sentence said.
Can you explain to me what it does mean?
Well, it read the words as the words say, and that this, and in the same way, what is Jack McDonald trying to say with regard to why did he need to mention the person's ethnic background? What you're saying is now that your interpretation of what Jack said was a positive recognition of somebody's ethnic background, and that what Right Honourable Winston Peters said is a negative interpretation of that person's ethnic background. Now, that's got to be in the eye of the beholder, I would say, do you?
But, these are two wholly separate issues, are they not, though? One is...
Well, they are, but I find it very difficult to be criticised on the one hand for a member of New Zealand First identifying a person's ethnic background when the Green Party, who's the person making all the noise about it, on the other hand, it's no problem for them to identify a person's ethnic background.
So you say that the Green Party have, have a similar rhetoric which they're putting out?
Well, what I'm saying is that Jack McDonald unnecessarily made reference to a person's ethnic background in a tweet on Sunday, and there's not a sound about it. It was not necessary to identify that this individual had an Asian accent. They were a New Zealander on a New Zealand plane talking in Te Reo Māori. And I'm asking for the standard to be the same, is what I'm asking for.
Right. Okay. So moving on then, current polling, as you mentioned just before, is showing that Labour is polling at 26 points, Greens and New Zealand First are at about 11. Do you think these statements will have any impact on a potential coalition to form a Labour-led government?
Well, New Zealand First isn't talking about coalitions with anybody at the moment. All numbers have an effect downstream. So once the final vote is taken and the percentages are out there, then obviously there's going to be an impact based on what those percentages are. But New Zealand First is incredibly focused on just this. We're getting to the election. We're getting the largest number possible for New Zealand First from the party vote, from the electorate vote for the 23rd of September. We're in no conversations with anybody about coalitions or negotiations at this stage at all.
Right, but hypothetically, would this have any impact at all?
Well, hypothetically, all numbers have an impact, don't they? So in an MMP environment, every single one of these percentages has an impact. But it's the variation of the impact is so wide that we could go round and round and round what might happen. But until the people vote, it's all pointless. It's pointless energy and pointless conversation.
Right. So essentially, New Zealand First is waiting until final results come out, until actually contemplating if a coalition might be a profitable venture, basically.
I don't know about profitable, because we don't actually make any more money than any other member of parliament when we get there. But
metaphorically.
I get what you're saying. And exactly. But you see, neither can anybody else. This is why we've always had a problem. We are accused of not telling the New Zealand public who we'll go with before an election. How anybody makes these statements before the people actually vote has always baffled me. I work with as many people across the House as I can, regardless of their party, to get the best outcome for New Zealand. In the last 6 years that I've been there, I've done that, which is why I had a bill passed unanimously by this House last Parliament. So up until the people vote and we know what the numbers are, then the day after we can have a look and see what we can do and how will it be the best outcome for New Zealand First voters and the direction of the country.
Right. And shortly after Today's statement, Peters came out at a public speech in Balclutha warning that there will be consequences to the Green Party. What is he insinuating here? What consequences is he talking about?
Well, I think a consequence already would be that it's affected my relationship with Green Party MPs. It has to. They've just stood up and said that, the politics that I stand for, they believe to be racist and divisive. So a consequence already is that my working relationship with Green Party MPs is affected. With regard to any other consequence downstream, you have to wait to see how the people vote, and then see what comes out.
Right.
But there's already been a consequence.
So there are no planned, retaliation against this at all.
No, well, we haven't had any conversation about retaliation. We've got far too much to do to spend our time, talking about trying to get back at the Green Party. Well, I haven't had any conversation like that at all. Ultimately, it's just disappointment. And, it's just disappointment, really.
Right. And so moving on to our second topic now, New Zealand First have released a policy announcing that they will see a stop to synthetic carpeting being installed in government-funded buildings and state housing, opting instead for wool. What is the purpose of this policy?
Ultimately, it's about supporting New Zealand. So that the purpose of the policy is that you've got New Zealand sheep farmers, wool producers, you've got New Zealand carpet mills, you've got New Zealand retailers, and I noticed that the Taxpayers Union came out about, what a dumb idea this is, that it would cost this much more money to actually put carpet and so on and so forth. What the Taxpayers Union doesn't seem to understand is that money is just a money go round. It comes, you know, it's paid from one person to another, and it's only when it leaves your country that it starts to leach away from the potential inside what is the New Zealand environment. So if we pay a New Zealand sheep farmer, who we've already paid for the roading to get the sheep there and all these other sort of things, we've already invested in these businesses. If we pay them to produce the wool and then go to a New Zealand carpet manufacturing plant where they're, with New Zealanders employed, and then we create that market, all those people pay tax on everything that we've just reinvested. And let's not forget, it's their money at the start of the equation.
Mm.
So it's their taxpayers' dollars that we're buying their product from, upon which they pay tax, and who employ the New Zealand workers, of which they pay tax. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. So why focus on like carpeting? Why not instill subsidies for wool farmers instead?
Well, because wool farmers don't want subsidies. They don't want to be considered beneficiaries of the taxpayer. They want, like every other New Zealander, they want to be validated. They want to give to their community and to their country, and they want to do it through hard work. They don't want a subsidy.
Mm. And what about costings for this? I can't imagine that recarpeting thousands of buildings is going to be cheap. So how much is all of this estimated to cost?
Well, it's not recarpeting, first of all. So we're not ripping up everything that's, that doesn't need to be ripped up and putting down wool carpet. What we're talking about is that under the government procurement plan, when you've got to replace carpeting, rather than decide you're going to go for an imported synthetic product, we are going to say that wool carpeting needs to be the first considered option. And we're talking about the same thing with regard to insulation. New Zealand produced wool insulation. So all we're saying is we want to give some real muscle to buy New Zealand made.
Right. So the purpose of this is to bolster that section of the market, essentially.
Yeah, the purpose is to support New Zealand farmers, New Zealand industry, and New Zealand employees.
Right, right. Thank you very much for joining us again this week, Tracy.
All right, you take care.
You too. See you later.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
Fresh from the kitchen, play it out, every Wednesday on the 1 till 4 show with Bridge. Bringing in a sonically seasoned basket full of goodness, foraged from the musical wild, Bridge lays down a lovingly prepared meal for your ears. Three delicious courses from the same album, served up one by one throughout the show. Play it out on the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge.
こちらは 95BFM Audible World です。
World music treats and bizarro ethnomusicological finds with Andrew McLeod and guests.
Look at you for living on me. FM Bicolton Durunama.
Let your ears bathe in all the splendor of the planet's oral delights. The Audible World, every Sunday night from 9 to 11 pm.
Ascoltate il mondo udibile. Radio 95 BFM.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, welcome back. And hello, Alan.
Hello,
How's
Alan.
How's it going?
It's going a bit coolly,
It's going a bit coolly?
Yes,
yeah, it has been a bit chilly this morning.
At least we're not in Dunners, I guess.
Yeah, so where's... Oh, yeah.
It's cold down there.
I don't even want to imagine what it's like in those horrible student flats down there.
Snow to sea level,
yeah,
apparently.
So to start out with, there are potentially toxic nanoparticles in baby formula.
Okay,
no?
There's potentially toxic nanoparticles everywhere. But,
yeah.
Okay, so there was a recent study at the State University of Arizona, or Arizona State University, and they were analyzing infant formula, and they found in two lots of infant formula very, very small crystals, or nanoparticles, if you will, of a thing called calcium hydroxyapatite.
Ooh.
And this got the Friends of the Earth a bit hot under the collar because the study was funded, I believe, by them. And they said, right, these nanoparticles are potentially bad and we should ban them, and everyone should be very wary of these nasty things.
Yeah.
So what are nanoparticles? Question one. So nanoparticles, as the name possibly suggests, are very, very, very small particles. So nano in scientific terms means 10 to the power of minus 9.
Right.
Which is 0.00000001.
Yeah, I think that was 9.
Of a meter. So a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 of a meter. And so obviously really, really, really tiny scale. And they've been a very hot topic of research in science for the past maybe 20-odd years, 10 to 20 years, because what people have found is that matter on the very, very, very small scale can behave quite differently to the large-scale version of the same thing.
Right.
For example, things like gold nanoparticles, so just very, very, very finely divided gold does some quite weird things that sort of bulk gold doesn't do. And obviously with any new technology, and this is a new technology, they're looking at using nanoparticles, for example, as drug delivery agents. So these aforementioned gold nanoparticles, you can coat these with a drug, and then you can potentially localize them at a point in the body where you want them to go, and they can go and release the drug, and the drug does its business, so et cetera, et cetera.
A replacement for a pill, kind of.
And so a lot of work's been going on in them, and as I said, with any new technology come possibly attendant risks, or possible risks. And one of these possible risks is the very, very tiny size of these things. So people think that because they're really, really small, that maybe they can get into parts of the body that they shouldn't be getting into. They could be potentially toxic, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So they found nanoparticles in these infant formulae. And so there was a debate over whether these things were actually added to the infant formula or whether they occurred naturally.
Right.
And so the manufacturers of these things are saying, no, of course we didn't add these to the formula. And my take on it is that they've probably occurred naturally. Because what you do to make milk powder is basically you're dehydrating milk.
Yep.
You've got calcium in milk. You've got phosphate anions. You've got hydroxide anions. All of those three hook up to make calcium hydroxyapatite. Normally in a different type of form. But potentially when you're taking the liquid water off of these things, you're dehydrating them, then there's no reason why these things can't occur naturally as well. And they, as I understand it, present in very, very, very tiny amounts. As soon as they get into the body, they're just going to dissolve anyway.
Yeah, so in stomach acid and
yes,
things
indeed.
Like that.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So as soon as they get into any sort of acidic environment, then they're going to be gone. So I think sort of the Food Safety Authority were pretty unconcerned about the whole thing and saying it's a bit of a storm in the teacup and a bit of alarmist stuff. So I guess, I don't know, the jury might still be out on it, but I don't really think it's anything to worry about. I think they're just essentially naturally occurring very, very small particles.
Yeah.
And we come into contact with those sort of every day, naturally occurring things in very, very finely divided form. So
yeah. I guess I think one of the main concerns was that it was it similar to asbestos in the way it's shaped?
Yes, indeed. But the difference with asbestos is that that's not soluble. Okay. Now asbestos, yes, very, very nasty, gets into the lungs and you're a goner, basically. But and they made a big thing about the fact that these had sharp edges and stuff. But,
yeah.
But you know, when they're dissolving, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter.
Doesn't make any difference. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I also remember reading that was it that they the study that they're using, they injected mice with, it was like eight times the amount that you'd actually get, or something even more significant than that.
So this was, I think, an intravenous injection, think, as well. So, very far away from sort of an
completely
oral
different.
Yeah,
completely
there we go.
Completely different.
You understand it. I understand it. Yeah. You know, so.
Why does no one else?
If you were, reading about a study about a study like that and say you're a parent and you see a headline like that and you're really, you know, it's quite scary.
Yes.
What things do you look for in a story about a scientific study to know whether to take it seriously or not?
That's a really, really good question. I wish I had the straight-off answer to that. See, this was carried out at a reputable university. So Arizona State, so it's a decent American university. I think the one thing that might perhaps set alarm bells ringing is that it was funded by Friends of the Earth. So you know, if you're something like this, you can't have sort of interest groups or special interest groups providing the funding for something that they basically want to find out, you know. I think it's got to be totally independent. It's like sort of, you know, cigarette companies funding research into nicotine addiction or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not without bias. I'm not saying that, but it's not without potential bias, I guess. So, you know, look at who's doing the research. you know, is it a credible organisation, and look at definitely who's funding the research, because I think that's the most important thing.
Mm, definitely.
Yeah.
Cool. So moving on to our second story. Mm-hmm. So the Grand Canyon has been sued by creationists.
Which makes sense, because the only people who would think of suing a rock would be creationists.
Ooh, that's good. Burn.
Please explain, Alan. Please explain.
I wish I could. Okay. This one's got a little bit of a back history, and it's kind of interesting. So the guy that is behind this is a man by the name of Dr. Andrew Snelling.
Right.
And he is an Australian, and he has a bona fide PhD in geology from the University of Sydney.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, oh, indeed. Wow. Yes, I know, I know.
This reminds me, I had a biology teacher who would only cover evolution as strictly as possible to the adhered curriculum. Mm-hmm. And if you ask questions surrounding anything else, he'd be like, I don't believe in evolution. How does someone get into that position?
Good question. Yeah. But people do, I guess. So this guy has done, again, seemingly bona fide research in sort of Australian geology. And then since, about 2007 or something, he's been on the board of a thing called AnswersInGenesis.com.
A credible source, I imagine.
Which the website name basically says it all. So what he is a young Earth creationist. So he reckons that the Earth is somewhere between 6 and 10,000 years old, and that everything can be explained by the Bible, and that all of the geology, all of the current geology of the planet came about as a result of the Great Flood.
Mm.
Okay. And that lasted for about a year and everything, and then all the mountains started rising and blah, 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 blah. So he wants to get into the Grand Canyon and get some rock samples from the Grand Canyon to further his quote-unquote, and I'm doing the air commas here, people, research into this age of the Grand Canyon / age of the Earth. And so initially he was refused by the powers that be. I mm-hmm. think they were, I did have it written down there, the Grand Canyon National Park and the U.S. Department of the Interior. So he was refused permission to take rock samples from by these guys. And so he went and bought legal action against them. And sadly, as you do, they sort of caved because...
Really? So he won?
He won. Oh. So... Really, really. Well, this is Trump's America now.
Yeah,
you know?
True.
So,
true.
So basically, they relented, and now they have allowed him to take rock samples from the Grand Canyon. Now, I guess the point that's been made is that access to the Grand Canyon, I mean, the Grand Canyon is obviously an amazing geological site,
mm-hmm.
and so you don't really want to disturb it too much if you can possibly get away with that. And so access or scientific access is limited to a very, very small number of highly qualified people, scientists. And he was arguing that he was basically being refused on the basis of his faith, that he wasn't allowed to take the things, whereas he being refused on the basis that him taking samples is not going to advance science one iota. But sadly, that's now what is going to happen, so that his pseudoscience is now going to gain possibly some credibility on the basis that now he's going to take these rock samples and he's going to subject them to whatever research he does. And come out with yet more papers in so-called peer-reviewed creation journals.
Mm.
They really are peer-reviewed because they would only go to fellow creationists. Yes, so that's the absolute definition of peer review, I guess.
This is all harking back to a few weeks ago where we had a discussion surrounding not fraudulent, but not to be believed peer-review documentation.
Yes, and indeed.
You've got to look into who's actually peer-reviewing said articles.
Yes, yeah, of course you do. Yes, So that, it's very, very sad, unfortunately. It's a very sad thing, but, you know, this is the post-truth era, seemingly, so anything can happen.
Reality is weirder than fiction. And speaking of creationism still, apparently a new law in Florida will mean that residents can challenge anything that is taught in a science class. Please explain.
I know.
This just sounds like a sad, sad thing.
So not unrelated to the previous story, but so you're right. So there's a law just been passed in Florida basically saying that anybody any resident of the Sunshine State can object to anything that's being taught in any public school in the state, and they don't have to have a kid. They don't even have to have a kid at the school.
Really?
So, yeah, really. Yeah, yeah.
So if I were living in Florida,
yep,
and I didn't like geology because I hate rocks.
Yep.
Rocks are horrible things.
Yep.
I could just waltz in there and be,
yep,
like, do not teach these children about geodes.
Yep. And apparently the school boards have got to employ some sort of supposedly neutral person who then has to organise an investigation into all of this. And if it's found that geology's bad, then they tell the school to remove it from the curriculum.
So this is basically allowing a forum for nut jobs to give their own opinion in an education system, which sounds like the most inherently flawed thing.
You're not wrong. Yes. Yeah. It is hard to believe, but it's happening. And there's one possible bright side to all of this. We normally think, as you say, nut jobs, couldn't put it better myself, coming in and saying, I don't like this, I don't like that, get rid of it. And obviously it's going to be creationism and climate change, obviously the two things. But, you know, you could look at it on the other hand, and hopefully there's a few committed individuals from the other side of the fence who will go and say, right, let's get these Bibles out of schools and everything. It's, you know, separation of church and state.
There's
and all that
a
stuff.
Silver lining to it, isn't there?
A potential one.
Potential.
But sadly, it's the nut jobs that seem to have the time on their hands to be able to do this stuff.
Yes,
while,
definitely,
dare I say it, the sensible people are out there sort of, you know, advancing the world,
yeah,
and just sort of looking past all of this stuff. But it's going to be very, very interesting to see how, yeah, this all works out.
Has this been like a trend around the states? Have we seen similar things occur elsewhere?
Well, I would have thought Florida would have been a little bit more sensible than that, but yeah, I guess they did go Trump last election, didn't they? You'd sort of be thinking, you know, your, dare I say it, you know, your Kansases and your Missouris and, you know, places out sort of, out in the Great Plains
good old
and stuff.
Bible Belt.
Yeah. Let's hope this isn't a trend. Let's hope it's not the start of a countrywide thing.
Mm. Yes.
Because it's not good.
It's almost good. Like ignorance is cool now.
I don't know if I'd go as far as saying maybe more acceptable.
Yeah.
It's a more acceptable thing. Because, you know, as you were saying, just for post-truth,
yeah,
reality.
It's ignorance kind of is cool. I like that. Get the t-shirt, mate. That's good. and spell it K-O-O-L. But, you know, that would, you know.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again this week, Alan.
Thank you, Adam. And it's, I hear good, that this is your last wire.
It's my last wire.
Yes, my,
yes,
goodness.
Oh, I know.
Yes.
I know. I didn't actually announce it before, but now it's been taken out into the airwaves. Yeah.
It's been a pleasure working with you.
Yes, you too, Alan.
Yeah.
I hope I'll see you around anyway.
Yeah, good luck in your new venture.
Cheers. See you later.
See ya.
That was Dear Science.
Hey, can you play the new Iris Cyrus song?
We just played that.
Oh. Can you play the other one?
Yeah, why not?
Here at BFM, we believe that variety is bad, and some albums are so good they deserve a proper airing. So that's what we're gonna do! Every Saturday during Totally Wired, NZ On Air Music presents Long Player, spinning a recently released local album in full, with interviews and anecdotes from the artists themselves. NZ On Air Music presents Long Player, every Saturday from 1 as part of Totally Wired.
Every Friday night, BFM's got you covered for the best tunes to preload to.
I knew I'd get what I asked for.
With a revolving cast of BFM's favourite long-serving selectors, it's the Gang of Four. Gang of Four, with Renee Jones, Pat Fife, Phil Armstrong and The Professor. Fridays 7-9pm on 95BFM.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire. And if you have anything to say about any of the stories which we have talked about today, remember you can give us a call on 309 3879 or give us a text message on 5395. Now coming up is a story by India. Take it away.
On Friday, it was announced that the production of Mana magazine would be put on hold indefinitely by its owner, Mana Productions, who says at this stage they do not intend to continue publishing it. For the past 3 years, the magazine's license has been held by Corfi Media, who employed former music journalist Leonie Hayden as its editor. The license returned to Mana Productions this month, and on Twitter, Hayden has described their current stance of not continuing with the magazine as a waste. I spoke with Leonie Hayden about the importance of Mana magazine, Corfi's unsuccessful bid to buy the title, and her new project with the spin-off. What's your understanding of the reasons that Mana Productions is no longer publishing the magazine?
So, when Corfi Media took over the license to publish Mana, we agreed that we'd sort of start negotiations 6 months before that license ran out to try and purchase the title. So that happened 6 months ago. We made an offer to Mana Productions on behalf of Corfi Media. We made an offer based on the small amount of profit that we'd been able to turn over that 3 years or 2.5 years, plus a little bit more. And it was a reasonable offer, and it was certainly a lot more than a lot of magazines sell for these days. I myself once worked for a magazine that ended up being sold for $1. So we thought we were offering quite a good price, but we had our offer rejected. You know, and that's their right to reject their offer, I guess. But we were also aware, based on, you know, working in publishing and knowing that environment quite well, that there was no other publishing company in New Zealand that would make a similar offer. Because, you know, with a title that niche as well, requires certain skills and sensitivities. And even if you're sort of asking, you know, if you're asking Māori organisations, which is what the Mana Productions are now sort of doing, like casting the net wider and saying Māori organisations should step up and buy this title, which is all well and good if all he wants is more money, but at the end of the day, you still require a publishing company to publish that magazine. You know, not just anyone can do it, and I think that maybe sounds arrogant, but you know, you need a fire station to put out fires. You need, you know, people who know how to do a job to do the job. You can't just sort of buy a magazine and then all of a sudden you know how to publish a magazine. So we genuinely thought we were the best people for the job, and we made an offer that reflected our respect for the title as well as what it was actually worth in the current market, and it was rejected.
Right, because I read that Corfi's director said that, yeah, Mana did perform well. Obviously, it's very tough for magazines at the moment.
Yeah.
So what would you say that were its strengths that allowed it to do so well?
So the person that would have been quoted is the director of Corfi Media, which is James Frankham. And frankly, he was what allowed it to perform so well. Corfi Media owns New Zealand Geographic, and he bought that magazine after their owners had announced that they would stop publishing it. And he is just a really smart, resourceful, enterprising guy who knows how to turn a magazine into an ecosystem, if that makes sense. Because you can no longer just publish a magazine. You know, you've got your bigger players like Bauer and Fairfax and whatnot, and APN, who, in order to stay afloat, they have to publish many magazines to keep those titles going. But James figured out how to just create lots of really great sort of satellite projects that you can attach to your magazine, which also create revenue, and then that way your magazine can continue to just sort of be the jewel in the crown, and you can put a lot of work into making it look beautiful, to actually paying writers and photographers enough to produce really great quality content. And I think personally he does that better than anyone in New Zealand, so that's the expertise he was starting to put into Mana. And it took us, you know, a long time, it took us a couple of years to even get it sort of with its head above water, you know what I mean? Like, we didn't lose any money, but we certainly weren't making money hand over fist, even though we were putting all of our considerable time and resources and expertise into it. So the next step was logically to buy it, but then to also invest more money in it so that we could build other things like a digital archive and, you know, like sort of events that you can sort of stage annually, which attract sponsors, and you tie those to the magazine. And it's all this like quite beautiful ecosystem that keeps everything going, but it also means you can have a small core staff that are paid well for what they do and also enjoy what they do without sort of that job insecurity that a lot of the publishing industry experiences.
Yeah, and I guess it's about, you know, a magazine's value isn't necessarily just about what money it's turning over either.
No.
And I wanted to ask you, what do you think were some of the most important stories that you covered during your time as editor?
Oh, there was a few. I suppose one of the limitations of a magazine, I guess, is you can't send a really great story as widely as you'd like, because we actually published a story about Auckland's housing crisis, reporting on the fact that families were living in cars months and months before that hit the headlines. That was a story by Aaron Snail, and that was a really important story for us, and I do wish that had gone further. We did a story last year on youth suicide about two specific areas, Northland, which is featuring again in Herald's really great coverage, and also down in Christchurch, where a lot of people were affected after the earthquake. We've done sort of really great investigations into Māori language, over-incarceration of Māori men, you know, all these sort of big-ticket stories that sort of need to be revisited every few years. I think we did quite well by those over the last couple of years.
So if another magazine was to step up, or not necessarily a magazine, but another platform was going to step up and fill the gap that you feel Mana has left, what values or sensitivities, as you say, would it need to have?
I think the most important thing for a Māori platform is to use Māori voices. And even within that, you're still looking at a range of perspectives and experiences, but we're sort of at the point where you can no longer have, you know, like a cishet white male talking about diversity. You know, the communities themselves need to be at the centre of every conversation about those communities. So Māori platforms that are talking about Māori issues need to be by and for Māori. So the section that we are hopefully about to launch soon for the spin-off, it's going to be run and edited by me, and I'll be carrying over some of my contributors from Mana so that their voices are at the centre of that. Like, I think that's the most important thing. And then other than that, I think the other important thing to realise is there's just millions of stories, you know, like, and it doesn't always have to be about settlement and child abuse and incarceration. Those are really, really, really important issues. But the stuff that falls through the cracks and the amazing, like, colourful characters, and, you know, there's this wealth of stories out there in Te Ao Māori that are just sort of waiting to be talked about and presented. And so I'm hoping to keep doing that work, because I do think it's really important, rather than just always being in the news for to do with crime, you know. I mean, we sort of, when it's second to last issue, we did this amazing story on the Māori approach to infertility and some of the natural rongoā Māori practices that can be involved in that versus or complementary to IVF. You know, there is a Māori perspective on everything in our world, because we live in this world, and so there's so much to tell.
So you said that you're going to be working with the spin-off. Is that confirmed, or is that sort
yes?
Of something
oh, I'm already works? I'm already working as a staff writer at the spin-off, then we're hoping to launch our Māori section very soon.
Can anyone explain why the modern day Wales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Leonie Hayden, the former editor of Mana magazine, speaking about the owner halting its publication. And we'll just be back after this song.
Yeah.
was The Wire.
Yes, and that marks the end of another Wire for this week. For this Wednesday, I should mean, actually, because there's Wires tomorrow and the next day. But thank you to all those who spoke with us for our pieces today. That was Frank Hogan, Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, and Leonie Hayden. Thanks heaps to Will and India for helping with production this morning. And thank you all for tuning in. Shamina will be back next week. Stay tuned for the 1-4 coming up right after this.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.